finding either were slight. In Killen's judgment, the odds were so long that there was no point in raising these issues while Kansas was on the stand. Now on the offensive, Flanagan called Dr. Werner Spitz, deputy chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland, who testified that it was good as impossible for a pathologist to determine whether a person had drowned or asphyxiated. You may exhume the girl and examine her and still not know whether she drowned, Spitz said. Drowning was one of the most difficult diagnoses to make in forensic pathology, because it so frequently resembled other causes of death. How then, Denise wanted to know, could Spitz be so medically certain Mary Jo Kopechne had drowned? Because of the circumstances which are being related to me, Spitz said. The question here is, shall the deceased be exhumed? That is not the question, Denise snapped. The question is whether or not you can eliminate any other cause of death other than drowning. She may have injuries which I cannot determine upon external examination of the body, and that was good enough for Denise. No further questions, he said, cutting Spitz off. I didn't finish the sentence, Spitz protested. Braminski allowed Spitz to continue, and may have wished he hadn't. She may have injuries, Spitz went on. There is no question in my mind that at this point she also inhaled water. It is also apparent to me from the record that she lived for a certain time underwater. Otherwise, why should the froth have developed? You're talking about pink foam, Spitz added, warming up to his subject. That foam is the combination of water and protein that is being shaken, and the shaking action is the breathing action. So she breathed, that girl. She breathed. She wasn't dead instantaneously. You're not going to find a cause of instantaneous death whether you exhume her or you don't. Flanagan looked stricken. In his peroration, Spitz had medically corroborated John Farrar's long-held opinion, heretofore excluded from testimony, that Mary Jo Kopechne had lived for a time in the submerged car, an admission that, because it came from a defense witness, was especially damaging. Flanagan got Spitz off the witness stand in a hurry, but the damage was done. Not only had Spitz legitimized Farrar's theories, he had floated a pretty good reason to exhume an autopsy Mary Jo Kopechne himself. The issue Kennedy's lawyers feared the most was the Walensky decision as a basis for bringing a manslaughter charge, Fernandez said later. They were scared to death of that case, because an omission to act constitutes negligence under the law. If Senator Kennedy had abandoned a living, breathing passenger in his car, and his failure to notify police and rescue personnel could be shown to have contributed to her death, he was guilty of manslaughter. Flanagan moved swiftly to recoup. He called Spitz's boss, toxicologist Dr. Henry Freimuth, chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland. Freimuth testified that the stains on the blouse Mary Jo Kopechne had worn at the time of her death were typical of those produced by the pinkish froth discharged from the nose and mouth of drowning victims. In a drowning case, there will be blood foam in the airway from the rupture of very fine little vessels. You don't need much blood to give it a pinkish hue, Freimuth said. The foam could come out of the mouth, roll down the side of the face, and stain the clothing of a drowning victim. Stains that gave positive benzodiazepine reactions. In a few incisive phrases, Freimuth had disposed of Denise's blood evidence. From having heard the testimony in the courtroom, Joseph Kopechne felt more than ever, "We do not want an autopsy. My wife and I are unalterably opposed to it. It would be just like another funeral for us. We feel that they had a chance at an autopsy. It wasn't performed, and we absolutely do not want it now. We see no value in it at all." Braminski adjourned the session at 9 o'clock p.m. Denise was very near completion. Asked if he planned to call Senator Kennedy as a witness, Denise said, "That's always a problem, but not as of tonight." It certainly would be a problem. Having canceled a speech in August to be available in case his presence were required at an inquest, Kennedy was now out of the country, attending a NATO meeting in Brussels. Inevitably, speculation arose that Kennedy's lawyers did not want him testifying in open court, particularly when Denise intended to present evidence of inconsistency between the senator's two public statements about the accident. Denise took the witness stand the next day to defend himself against charges of inaction in the case, and his failure to have called for an autopsy earlier. There was no provision of law which put Denise under an obligation to make an immediate investigation of any case in his jurisdiction, he said. It was customary for district attorneys to take charge of cases when the investigation by local authorities was either unsatisfactory or incomplete. Denise would not have ordered an autopsy unless I was informed of sufficient facts to give me a reason to. After that information had been made available to him, Denise had positively ordered an autopsy, only to be told the body had already been flown off the island by the Kennedy people. As chief law enforcement officer for the Southern District, Denise was not satisfied with the cause of Mary Jo Kopechne's death as determined by Dr. Mills. Rominski ordered Denise's comments stricken from the record. It made no difference whether Denise was a district attorney, a judge, or a defense counsel, he said. You cannot come to a conclusion unsubstantiated by facts. Denise was undaunted. An autopsy, he said, was necessary to ascertain the legal cause of death and to resolve the contradictions between Senator Kennedy's two statements about the accident. Denise had wanted the statements entered into evidence in lieu of the senator's presence as a witness in the courtroom. But with Kennedy's accident report excluded, there was no point in offering Kennedy's television speech as Denise proceeded to do. Without the police report, there would be no basis for finding inconsistency. Once again, Flanagan objected. The speech was a self-serving declaration, immaterial and irrelevant to the issue of the hearing. Inexplicably, Rominski said he would allow it, if an accurate reproduction could be found. Denise had a transcription of the broadcast supplied by radio station WBZ in Boston. So it was that, into the packed courtroom, came the voice of Teddy Kennedy, delivering a speech that sounded to many just as facile and manipulative as it had originally, and every bit as indefensible as Kennedy said his actions after the accident had been. Rominski adjourned the hearing at 3:15 p.m. An hour later, he was handing out refreshments and dancing with supporters at a campaign rally. Rominski bristled at the suggestion he intended to delay his decision to exhume and autopsy Mary Jo Kopechne until after the election. That's unfair. I have to wait until the court stenographer completes the transcript of the hearing before I can make a ruling. Denise told reporters as he left the courthouse that he was satisfied that the allegations in his amended petition had been proved. I can't think of a single instance where we were disheartened. Everything we tried to achieve was achieved. Denise had been treated fairly, he said. We will abide by the decision. I don't think we'll go any further on appeal if we lose. Chapter 47. On October 30th, 1969, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court granted Senator Kennedy's request that the press and public be barred from the inquest. The court ruled that, while the procedure was not accusatory, if it were held in public, the activities of the news media may be such as to make it difficult, if not impossible, for a long time to ensure a defendant a fair trial in any criminal proceedings which may follow. The Kopechne inquest presented unusual problems by arousing great public interest, which in turn had stimulated efforts by the press to provide coverage. The difficulty had not been lessened by Senator Kennedy's own resort to television, which may itself have increased public interest and demand for a more complete investigation and explanation of those events, the court said. Nevertheless, the risk of prejudice from pre-trial publicity remained. The court was not making a special rule for a particular case. No other inquest was likely to arouse such public interest, but similar risks of prejudice could occur to citizens less well known or able to protect themselves. They too must be afforded the protection that was now being accorded Senator Kennedy. The court's ruling would apply to all future inquests in Massachusetts. But to amend an 82-year-old procedure to accommodate one of the champion self-promoters of modern times was indeed a special case. That the court should cite great public interest as a reason to close the inquest was an irony not overlooked by editorialists. Rather than a gathering crescendo of publicity, the press had only exposed a crescendo of bungling in the legal process by authorities too willing to absolve the senator of anything beyond leaving the scene of the accident, the Wall Street Journal charged. Now, a curtain of secrecy was being dropped over the inquest, so the bumbling can continue safe from prying eyes. Public confidence in the administration of justice in Massachusetts had once again been seriously impaired by the special consideration given to Senator Kennedy. Sooner or later, the full and complete story about what happened that night on Chappaquiddick will come out, despite all attempts to keep it smothered, the New Bedford Standard Times said. For this case, involving as it does a man who was, and may be again, considered almost a shoe-in for the presidency of the United States, has too many unanswered questions. So far, despite all the planted stories about how Senator Kennedy wants to tell the people the full and complete story of Chappaquiddick, he has consistently turned away from all opportunities to do so. Senator Kennedy hadn't read the decision released while he was en route from Washington, he told reporters at Boston's Logan Airport, but he was satisfied the court had acted judiciously. Kennedy hoped the inquest would get underway as soon as possible, so I can get on with representing the people of Massachusetts. Asked if he would be a witness at the inquest, Kennedy said, I'll conduct myself in whatever way the court recommends. But no court ruling could relieve Kennedy of the requirement to put the full story of what had happened before or after the accident on the record. He had only bargained over the circumstances under which he would answer questions, not whether the questions had to be answered. The senator couldn't give the account now, because he would violate the order of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court for secrecy, his office disclosed. But once the inquest was over and Kennedy was free to talk, he intended to give a detailed public accounting of what he knew about the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Kennedy's plan to do so is based on the assumption that the inquest would not produce any criminal action against him. Although Senator Kennedy got what he asked for, the court struck down the constitutional pretext upon which his appeal was based. No witness at an inquest was entitled to the due process rights accorded to persons on trial. The court did grant Hanafy's request that inquest documents be made public only after all probability of criminal prosecution had passed, indictment sought or returned by a grand jury, or following the trial of any person named in the inquest report as responsible for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. The court, however, refused to disqualify Judge Boyle, and left all other procedural aspects of the inquest to his discretion. Boyle was not upset by the decision. He wasn't the least inclined to create a new interpretation of the concept of the inquest, whose roots went back to 1887. I never thought a court of Milo rank had for its function the making of law, he said at a two-hour meeting with Kennedy's attorneys, Denise, and his staff to discuss the court's new inquest guidelines. Boyle declined to set a date for the inquest until Judge Brominski ruled on the Denise petition for exhumation and autopsy. He suggested no comment be made by participants in that closed conference. Edgartown police had guarded the doors of the courtroom, which had been searched for concealed electronic recording devices, a procedure to be followed every day of the inquest to guarantee the secret nature of the proceedings, as ordered by the Supreme Court, be maintained. Gwen Kopechne didn't care whether the inquest was closed or open. I just wish they'd hurry up and get it over with. We were disappointed when it was postponed, although we knew there were good reasons for it. But we're totally opposed to an autopsy. The answers to the questions are in Massachusetts, not here, she said. I just wish Mr. Denise would have his inquest and clear up this whole situation. On Tuesday, November 18th, 1969, at 11:04 a.m., Joseph P. Kennedy died in his sleep at the age of 81. A white mass was celebrated at St. Francis Xavier Church in Hyannis by Richard Cardinal Cushing. Senator Kennedy paid tribute to Anne Gargan's loyalty, devotion, and great love as a companion to his father, invalided by a stroke in 1961. In lieu of a eulogy, Kennedy read a passage from a privately printed volume of family reminiscences, The Fruitful Bough, written by Robert Kennedy, whose 44th birthday the funeral also observed. 3 days later, a memorial mass at the church marked the 6th anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination. Senator Kennedy objected to certain unjustified statements in Newsweek's obituary of his father, complaining, "We who are in public life must learn to live with petty gossip and baseless slander." Senate colleagues were reported astounded by Kennedy's resilience, his determination to assert strong leadership on major issues. Kennedy was regaining confidence and spirit, recovering remarkably from the gloom of Chappaquiddick. Great spells of depression had been commonplace then for what he had done to the family name and the memory of his slain brothers. Among friends, Kennedy was again able to laugh and enjoy himself. Those who knew Kennedy said, "He's snapping back." The senator acknowledged he was feeling better. Not having to read about the case in the newspapers every day helped. He was now awaiting the inquest, eager to clear up all the remaining questions about the accident, and stepping up his schedule of public appearances on behalf of his campaign for re-election. Kennedy denied he would seek to surpass his record 1.2 million winning margin in 1964, he said, "but I think we'll win big." Crimmins was back chauffeuring Kennedy in Boston. Gargan was once again advancing campaign stops. It was politics as usual, and a public display of confidence. With an informer installed in the district attorney's office, Kennedy was assured of a pipeline to whatever disclosures might come out of further police investigation. But the inquest cast shadows nonetheless over an election it was conceded Kennedy had too formidable a lead to lose. But the senator had every reason to be optimistic. He had altered a judicial procedure which had stood for 82 years, stilled as much talk about the case as it was possible for his media controllers to do, and blocked a police investigation, while at the same time maintaining a public posture of cooperating fully with the inquiry. His attorneys had won every legal round in the courts. Another victory was imminent. On Wednesday, December 1st, Judge Brominski barred the exhumation of Mary Jo Kopechne. There was, he ruled, no evidence to indicate anything other than drowning had caused the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Even if an autopsy revealed a broken neck, a fractured skull, or the rupture of internal organs, none of these would be incompatible with the manner which this accident occurred, Brominski said. Evidence of bloodstains on Mary Jo Kopechne's clothes had been wholly consistent with death by drowning. To justify his ruling required that Brominski travel peculiar corridors of logic. That the accident may have occurred at 12:50 a.m. on July 19th rather than 11:15 p.m. on July 18th did not suggest a cause of death other than drowning. While an acknowledgement of Huck Look's testimony, Brominski dismissed the idea that even if Senator Kennedy had lied about the time of the accident and his reason for turning onto Dyke Road, this was not sufficient to cast doubts on other reported aspects of the accident. To consider any other cause of death at this time would give loose rein to speculation unsupported by any medical facts of record, Brominski said. In fact, the lack of an autopsy guaranteed speculation and rumor would continue to flourish. Brominski had taken the opposition of the Kopechnes into account in making his decision, he said. While their disapproval was no absolute bar to an autopsy, in view of the facts presented, their objections are well taken. In so holding, Brominski challenged a ruling by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1956, which said that the purpose of an inquest was to protect the public. Any doubts about a death favored holding an autopsy. If a coroner failed to do so, it is the duty of the court to have the body exhumed and an autopsy performed. Yet, by finding Mary Jo Kopechne could have died from no other cause than drowning, and that an autopsy was not necessary to establish a legal cause of death, Brominski had established his own judicial precedent. The decision came as no surprise to Denise. As a candidate in a heavily Democratic district, Brominski had played politics every step of the way, holding the petition hostage to his own re-election bid. He even waited until he won a new 10-year term on the bench before making his ruling. To criminal attorney Melvin Belli,
"The irony is the public's impression that the JFK autopsy was unsatisfactory, and now Teddy Kennedy's female companion gets none," he said. "The Kennedy family is hiding the actions of those 2 days. They've gone around parading themselves as sponsors of the little people, and yet let that little person in the backseat of a car go unexamined to the grave."
Brominski's ruling pleased Gwen Kopechne.
"I can't tell you how wonderful I feel," she said. "Now I know my daughter will not be disturbed and will be at rest. I could never have gone up to that cemetery again if I knew she'd been disturbed."
She and her husband had agreed.
"If in any way we had felt we were obstructing justice by fighting exhumation of Mary Jo's body, we would have yielded in favor of an autopsy. But I know what drowning is. I've seen drowned persons before. When I saw my daughter, I could tell she had drowned."
But speculation of sexual misconduct attached to the accident was clearly on Mrs. Kopechne's mind. Anxious as she was to preserve her daughter's reputation against reports challenging the characterization of Mary Jo as the most straight-laced of the boiler room crew. One such report said that at a party in Washington 1 month before Chappaquiddick, Mary Jo was somewhat vocal and demonstrative, even sitting on the lap of a man who was someone else's date. She had a little too much to drink and was flirting and more girlish than usual. Mrs. Kopechne said,
"Mary Jo was a wonderful girl, so aware and full of life. Nobody had announced it. How could you? But there was an examination of my girl, and it showed she was a maiden lady."
Now the Kopechnes were patiently waiting for the start of the inquest. That Judge Boyle had refused to allow them or their attorneys to attend was upsetting.
"Because we're the parents of this girl, and it's as if we don't exist," Mrs. Kopechne said.
"The whole thing has been a mystery," Joseph Kopechne added. "There's a lot of questions we want answered.
You have to have a daughter to know how we feel. People are saying, 'Your kid was dead before she hit the water.' But I don't give a damn about the public. I just want to know what happened."
Senator Kennedy telephoned the Kopechnes to express his pleasure at Brominski's ruling.
"Because I realize how much it means to the Kopechne family. It increases their peace of mind, and I'm grateful for that."
It was now Kennedy's hope that the authorities in Massachusetts will move forward, so the entire matter can be concluded as soon as possible. Judge Boyle scheduled the inquest for Monday, January 5, 1970. "We wanted him to have the inquest before Christmas," a Kennedy aide disclosed, but the judge couldn't make the arrangements. Boyle wasn't being intractable.
"That's just the way he is," Jimmy Smith told Dave Mazzoni and Stephen Moulton, when Paul Markham's law partners called to find out what kind of a guy Boyle was.
Smith had known Boyle since his boyhood.
"I used to live across the street from him in Vineyard Haven.
Boyle's outspoken as hell. You either like him or you don't."
"Boyle was a Republican and a Protestant," Smith explained to the lawyers.
"He's not our kind of Irish." Chapter 48. On December 18th, private investigator J.E. Gautreau filed a final, confidential report to Edward Hanafy. His investigation had found nothing to compromise witnesses expected to testify at the inquest. But Gautreau had uncovered one piece of information with disquieting implications for Ted Kennedy's defense. An eyewitness who could possibly corroborate Huck Look having seen the accident car hours after the senator said it had gone off Dyke Bridge. Gautreau had tracked Nancy McDonald to Burlington, Vermont, a college student employed as a waitress at the Harborside Hotel during the summer. She and the assistant manager had walked to Edgartown Lighthouse Beach around 12:30 a.m. on Saturday, July 19th. They were seated on the dock when their attention was drawn to an automobile traveling at a high rate of speed on the road leading to the ferry slip on Chappaquiddick, 350 yards across the harbor. From the glow of the headlights, the car appeared to be neither a foreign nor a compact, but a large American-style automobile. The car stopped at the landing, and the headlights were turned off. To Miss McDonald and her companion, that seemed rather odd, since the ferry had closed down for the night.
That account suggested that Senator Kennedy had been driving around the island after leaving the party, and could have approached the landing before his confrontation with Huck Look. Information a state police investigation had failed to uncover. In fact, the investigation had produced no additional evidence since Bernie Flynn's meeting with Jack Miller in Washington, Flynn reported to Stephen Smith in late December.
The reason I called was to let him know we had nothing that's going to be embarrassing to Ted Kennedy at the inquest. They aren't going to ask him anything he doesn't know already.
Smith wanted to be sure.
There's nothing else you can tell us about evidence at the inquest.
Flynn had negative information which could be helpful, he said.
Smith asked Flynn to call him the next day at his office. When Flynn did so, Smith proposed a meeting at Logan Airport in Boston. Smith wasn't taking any chances. He wanted the negative information.
Flynn recalled, he told me the flight number and the time he was going to arrive.
Flynn was waiting at the ramp when Smith appeared.
A nice, athletic-looking fellow wearing a gray topcoat with a velvet collar.
Flynn said, I was kind of impressed with the mod haircut he had.
Flynn was surprised Smith was accompanied by Washington lawyer Jack Miller. Smith hadn't mentioned he was bringing Miller to the meeting. Miller was carrying a briefcase. He came over, shook hands, and introduced Stephen Smith. Smith suggested a drink in the airport's cocktail lounge.
Flynn was concerned someone might recognize him in the place. He was assured whoever knew him wouldn't know Smith or Miller.
Flynn ordered a scotch and water. Smith and Miller had drinks, too.
Miller was more at ease than he was in Washington, Flynn observed.
He put the briefcase on my left, almost in my lap. Looking down at it, I was almost going to tell him, take that briefcase and put it over there.
The first time in Washington, I didn't care. The second time around, I figured, why should I let him tape it again?
Seated across the table from Flynn, Stephen Smith said, is there anything more you can tell us?
Flynn filled them in on what he'd learned in regard to points that would be covered at the inquest.
What I was trying to do was, if they had any fears about something coming out at the inquest Ted Kennedy couldn't handle, I could allay those fears.
It's a nice feeling to know nothing is going to be thrown at you that's going to put you off your equilibrium, Flynn said.
I'm thinking of Ted Kennedy going into the inquest frightened, not knowing what's going to be dropped on him.
My whole thought was, I knew Ted Kennedy lied on TV. I didn't want him to go into an inquest and get caught in another lie.
This time when he tells his lie in the inquest, he can stick with the lie and they have to swallow it. He could walk into the inquest knowing there wasn't going to be any bombs dropped on him.
We don't have anything that could contradict Ted Kennedy except for Huck Look and the witness I had already discussed with Miller. I wanted them prepared for that. So I put their mind at ease that there weren't going to be any surprises. And they seemed to like that.
Flynn did most of the talking.
They're interjecting once in a while, he recalled later. This information I have is not like the last time I talked to Jack Miller. This is what I call negative information. The fact that we have nothing new. Everything is what I've already told you.
Smith came right back at him.
Are you sure there isn't anything else? He said.
No, that's it. That's why this information is so good, Flynn explained.
I'm trying to show him. This is worth your trip to Boston. This information is as important as me telling you something new. The fact that there isn't going to be anything Ted Kennedy won't be aware of. He can stick with the old story because he has nothing to fear.
Flynn had no idea what Eddie Denise's strategy was going to be at the inquest.
Except I know we had nothing, absolutely nothing. That's what I wanted to convey to them. The whole thing with me was I don't want to see Ted Kennedy get caught in any more lies at the inquest. The meeting with Stephen Smith and Jack Miller is to alleviate the feeling, am I going to get caught? I wanted Ted Kennedy to walk into the inquest and walk out, and he's protected.
Flynn realized, that's the reason the meeting was important to them. Otherwise they would have said, we don't want to talk to you, don't bother us.
But they wanted to talk to me, which indicated that Ted Kennedy was covering something up he didn't want to come out at the inquest.
That Kennedy's license had expired wasn't going to be brought up at the inquest, Flynn said.
That was nothing.
Telephone records had been subpoenaed. Flynn had served telephone company branch manager John O'Connor at the Cunnamesset Inn, he related. John was sitting at the bar with his wife having a cocktail. I told the waitress, "Take this Christmas card and give it to that man over there." She brought it over to his table. He opened it and looked around. He was a very startled man. He wasn't expecting it. He came over to my table laughing. He said to me, "You bastard." Stephen Smith said, "Are you sure there isn't anything else?" Flynn assured him again there wasn't. "If anything came up before the inquest, I'll get in touch with you." Smith wanted to know what Flynn expected in the way of payment for his services. "What can I do for you?" he said. "What did you want?" "You tell Ted Kennedy that I'm frightened. If this ever gets out, I'm cooked." Flynn was liable to a possible charge of conspiracy to obstruct justice or dismissal from the state police. The very least he could expect would be demotion and a punitive assignment to some remote and undesirable part of Massachusetts, Flynn said. "If I'm ever transferred to the western part of the state, I want help from Ted to get back to Cape Cod where I belong. I don't want to get stuck riding a camel in Pittsfield someplace." "That's no problem," Smith said. All Flynn had to do was make one telephone call. Flynn was satisfied he would never need to be concerned again about losing his plum assignment. To have helped Ted Kennedy was the best kind of job insurance to have. Except the premium had come high. In order to preserve his career as a police officer, Flynn had to betray it. Even so, Flynn tried to cover his tracks. Miller had placed his briefcase at Flynn's feet under the table. "While I'm talking to them, I'm tapping on it with my foot," Flynn recalled. "I'm kicking the side of the briefcase to interfere with the tape that was there." Flynn had maybe two drinks during the half-hour meeting. Smith and Miller caught the next shuttle back to New York. Smith turned up several days later to join Ted and Joan Kennedy on a skiing holiday at Vail, Colorado. Assured that no bombs were going to be dropped at the inquest, Senator Kennedy expressed confidence criminal charges were not likely to be developed against him at the inquest. He said, "Do you think that if I knew there was anything else that could come out of this, I would not have given up my Senate seat? I know what happened there, and I'm the only one who knows. There's nothing else that can be said about it." Kennedy returned to Washington on New Year's Day to meet with Jack Miller. He spent Saturday, January 3rd, and part of Sunday in Boston, rehearsing his testimony with his attorneys of record. Kennedy was not looking forward to the inquest, like he would to a party, an aide at the compound said. "It's painful for him, painful for the family. He wants to clear it up once and for all." The most painful question Senator Kennedy would be required to answer was why he had abandoned a helpless young woman in his car for 10 hours. His answer would have a lot to do with whether that action could be used to bring charges against him. Judge Boyle could contend his failure to alert authorities and rescue personnel had constituted criminal negligence and accused Ted Kennedy of willful, wanton, and reckless conduct by not reporting the accident. The Bridge of Chappaquiddick by Jack Olson was published on Friday, January 2nd. To ensure against leaks, access to a single copy of the manuscript was restricted to 3 employees of Little, Brown & Company of Boston. Despite precautions, a clandestine approach to a production supervisor at the Vail Ballou printing plant was made by a Democratic political figure, seeking a bootleg copy of the book in advance of publication. A bribe offer was made. Editor-in-Chief Elliot Fremont Smith assumed that it was ultimately from a Kennedy source. But Senator Kennedy had nothing to fear from the book, produced under the pressure of a narrow deadline. Olson failed to resolve any of the mysteries attending the accident. He'd had no luck with the senator or anyone close to the Kennedy family. To fill in the gap, Olson had expropriated Bernie Flynn's theory that Senator Kennedy had not driven the accident car off Dyke Bridge. Aware of the political implications of being on a deserted road late at night with a young, unmarried woman, Kennedy had stopped the car, gotten out, and told Mary Jo to circle back to pick him up, from fear a police officer would ask him questions. Seated behind the wheel of a strange and powerful car, she had no time to adjust the seat in order to reach the gas and brake pedals comfortably. Barely able to see the road ahead, Mary Jo had driven in a straight line off Dyke Bridge. Kennedy had given a different version of the accident because he had a public image to consider, Olson explained.
No intelligent politician would begin a police report by writing, "My brothers and I have a certain reputation. It is not deserved, but we have it. When I realized that I was in a very compromising position and might be interrogated by a police officer, I jumped out of the car."
A statement that would have ended Kennedy's career.
It would be simpler for Kennedy to fudge a few minutes off the time and claim he and Mary Jo had been headed for the ferry and taken a wrong turn on Dyke Road. Olson couldn't explain why Senator Kennedy should flee a police officer if he wasn't doing anything wrong. Driving a car on Chappaquiddick with an unmarried woman at any hour was no offense warranting an interrogation, unless Kennedy was afraid of being arrested for drunk driving. A portion of Flynn's theory Olson had omitted from his book. A more serious defect in the theory was, why, knowing a police officer had seen the car, did Kennedy think he could fudge an hour and a half off the time with a witness available to contradict him, as had proven to be the case with Huck Look? Olson thought a lot about the differential in the time Kennedy said he'd left the party and Look had seen the car, he said later.
The obvious answer was that they were playing around in the weeds.
This wasn't in the book. I didn't want to get sued for libel. It was enough to say Ted Kennedy was at a party with six unmarried women and had left with Mary Jo Kopechne. She's had a few drinks. She's very giddy and excited. She's with a Kennedy, a lifelong dream. He's probably been loving her up a little. Just to be in the car with him in the middle of the night on a deserted island. I couldn't say that in the book. But she must have been beside herself with excitement, a spinster girl. What was she, 28? Olson was in a very weird spot when he wrote the book.
The publisher and I were certain we were going to get hauled in for contempt of court or something like that. So many things were played down.
Olson's book puzzled Arena. If Kennedy wasn't in the car and not guilty of the transgressions everyone was accusing him of, why throw yourself to the wolves and say you were driving? That Kennedy felt the other story was the thing he should stick with. Well, he's certainly stuck with it now, because if he changes his story, who's going to believe him? Every time Arena thought about the various theories proposed to explain the accident, I say to myself, how come Kennedy knew enough to come to the station and tell me she went off the bridge if he wasn't in the car?
On Sunday evening, January 4th, Arena held an informal press briefing for about 400 reporters and photographers at the Communications Center, again set up in the basement of the Methodist Church. Security at the inquest would be strict. Witnesses would enter and leave the front door of the courthouse between a double file of police. Reporters would be required to stand behind barricades. Any witness who wanted to talk to the press could do so at the Communications Center. Otherwise, police will protect all witnesses, Arena said. Court clerk Tommy Teller was also observing the secrecy imposed on the proceedings by the Supreme Court, refusing to disclose the names of witnesses subpoenaed to appear at the inquest. Denise also declined to identify those he called to testify when he arrived at the Katamashur's motel on Sunday night. His entourage included bodyguard Robert Enos and staff assistants Peter Gay, Joseph Harrington, and Armand Fernandez. A cadre of Kennedy aides had arrived in Edgartown before the weekend to prepare for the inquest. Jim King of the senator's Boston office had sought accommodations for Kennedy witnesses and lawyers, and arranged for domestic help and catering services to provide meals. Richard McCarran rented a house on School Street as headquarters for Edward Hanafy and Robert Clark, and provided an apartment in the building he owned on Main Street for Dan Daly and Paul Redmond, where the boiler room girls would be served a daily luncheon. McCarran hired two locals as drivers for the young women, who arrived by chartered plane from Boston on Sunday afternoon. Miniskirted, more attractive and younger looking than their press pictures, they ignored shouted greetings from reporters and pleas from photographers to pose, moving resolutely toward the rental automobiles that would take them to the Blueberry Hill Guest Inn at Chilmark, 15 miles from Edgartown. It was in those same yellow Chevrolet sedans that the girls arrived at the Edgartown courthouse the next morning for the start of the inquest. Police cleared the sidewalk for the unsmiling young women to pass into the courthouse. Once inside, they were served with subpoenas. Their lawyer, Paul Redmond, had waited until the last hour to volunteer his clients to testify at the inquest.
Chapter 49. Senator Kennedy stepped off a chartered plane at Martha's Vineyard Airport at 9:15 a.m. He was looking forward to responding to any and all of the questions to be asked of him at the inquest into the death, not quite 6 months before, of Mary Jo Kopechne. Kennedy was hopeful the record would be completed, and I can get back to the business of devoting my energies to the Senate. Driven to the house on School Street, Kennedy conferred briefly inside, then stepped off a front porch for the 100-yard walk to the courthouse, accompanied by his wife and four state troopers. Arena had received instructions not to provide a heavy police escort when the senator entered or left the courthouse. Kennedy didn't want to look like a criminal on television. Kennedy was solemn when approached by a crowd of reporters. He acknowledged with a tense smile and a wave. One reporter called out, "Are you glad it's finally underway?" "Yes, I am," Kennedy said, waiting on the courthouse steps while his wife weaved through a throng of spectators on the sidewalk. Ready to open the courthouse door was Bernie Flynn, an historic moment preserved in a photograph he clipped from the New York Times. Though others did not then know it, Flynn was opening the door for Ted Kennedy to play the inquest game with a stacked deck, he said later. At stake was the pride of the Kennedys, and perhaps the presidency of the United States. When Joan Kennedy came out of the courthouse 10 minutes later, Dick Drain drew reporters' attention to the fact that, under Judge Boyle's rules, she couldn't stay inside, but she really wanted to accompany Ted to the courthouse. Mrs. Kennedy returned to the house on School Street to be greeted by Mary Frackleton and Jim King of the senator's Boston office, and court stenographer Joe Donegan. Donegan would reside at the house with Clark and Hanafy for the duration of the inquest. Also staying there was Herbert Jack Miller, Jr. Looming over the occupants of the house was the worry that the senator's two previous statements about the accident might be contradicted by witnesses at the inquest. Before those proceedings began, Kennedy came into the courtroom, empty except for Assistant District Attorney Peter Gay at the prosecutor's table. Gay greeted the senator warmly, showed him where the witness stand was, and was moved by the occasion to observe, "It was kind of sad, a U.S. senator to be put on trial like that." Promptly at 9 o'clock a.m., Clerk of the Court Tommy Teller formally opened the inquest, R.E. Mary Jo Kopechne. The inquest was not a prosecution of anyone, Judge Boyle told all lawyers and witnesses he'd summoned to the courtroom, in order to explain the purpose of the inquest, the results it was intended to accomplish, and the rules of procedure under which it would be held. The courthouse did not provide facilities for the sequestering of witnesses. However, he made it clear, witnesses after testimony are ordered not to discuss their testimony with anyone except his or her counsel. Boyle recognized a difficulty in this regard, with Redmond and Daly representing a substantial number of witnesses. "I don't want any attorney who heard what one witness said in the courtroom to reveal to another witness what the testifying witness said," Boyle said. He was specifically ordering attorneys not to discuss the testimony of one client with another client. Hanafy wanted to be sure he understood Boyle's order. "As an implicit instruction to all counsel present that we are to respect the privacy of the proceedings and are not to discuss with the press what goes on." But if Hanafy and the other lawyers knew perfectly well what Boyle had in mind, that would not prevent Boyle's instructions from being repeatedly and deliberately violated. Boyle excused everyone from the courtroom except Denise and his legal staff. In keeping with the secrecy order imposed by the Supreme Court, State Police Trooper Robert Enos and George Killen were asked to leave. Killen joined Bernie Flynn, assigned security duty in the corridor outside the courtroom, to summon witnesses. Before the inquest in September was postponed, Denise had proposed Chief Arena and other Edgartown locals testify first, followed by those who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick, with the exception of Paul Markham, Joseph Gargan, and Senator Kennedy. Denise had wanted them questioned last, and in that order.
Judge Boyle, however, had in mind a different arrangement. He would not keep a U.S. senator waiting.
Denise now proposed Robert Molloy, general accounting supervisor of the New England Telephone Company, to lead off the inquest. Boyle suggested Molloy was not to be called until some foundation was made to indicate his testimony was relevant. Note: Molloy's attorney, Charles Parrott, came to the courtroom prepared to offer four lists of telephone calls charged to Kennedy credit card accounts in Boston, Washington, and Virginia, and those billed to Park Agency Incorporated of New York, none of which showed any calls made during the hours after the accident, or before Kennedy called Helga Wagner after 8 a.m. at the Shiretown Inn. In a 9-page memorandum for his own files, Parrott observed, "There was no discussion about records of calls by putting dimes and quarters in the box, collect calls, or charging calls to your home number." Parrott denied any telephone company records had been withheld. Fernandez said, "Judge Boyle was only interested in a list of calls made from Martha's Vineyard on July 18th to 19th, as relevant to the issue of whether the senator had telephoned anyone after the accident." Compiled in chronological time sequence, the record doesn't at the moment tell me anything, Boyle said, when Molloy was on the witness stand. Denise saw no harm in offering the list into evidence. Denise called Senator Edward Kennedy as the inquest's first witness. Kennedy entered the courtroom accompanied by Hanafy and Clark. He took the witness stand in the near-empty courtroom to put on the record what he had avoided direct questioning about for more than 5 months. Because Kennedy had waited so long, "Anything he says will be weighed against two earlier statements that were less than persuasive," the New York Times said. "There is a risk that even the most dignified and straightforward mea culpa could bring his public career to a humiliating end." But there was nothing straightforward about what Kennedy put on the record. It was instead a latticework of evasions and omission, of half-truths and obfuscation, patched together by a phalanx of lawyers and advisers. Arriving at Edgartown on Friday, July 18th, Kennedy was brought to Chappaquiddick and driven over Dyke Bridge as a passenger in a four-door Oldsmobile 88 operated by Jack Crimmins. After a swim at East Beach, Kennedy was returned to Edgartown for the regatta race, then checked into the Shiretown Inn, visited with friends, and returned to Chappaquiddick to soak his back in a hot tub until party guests arrived in a rented Valiant around 8:30 p.m. Kennedy had initially tended bar. Then I think most of the individuals made their drinks after that. He had engaged in conversation and recollections with guests, which were old friends of myself and our families. He left the party at approximately 11:15 p.m., Kennedy testified. "I was talking with Miss Kopechne perhaps for some minutes before that period of time. I noticed the time, desired to leave, and return to the Shiretown Inn, and indicated to her that I was leaving and returning to town. She indicated to me that she was desirous of leaving, if I would be kind enough to drop her back at her hotel. I said, 'Well, I'm leaving immediately.' Spoke to Mr. Crimmins, requested the keys for the car, and left at that time." While his chauffeur drove him on practically every occasion, Mr. Crimmins, as well as some of the other fellows attending the cookout, were concluding their meal, enjoying the fellowship, and it didn't appear to me necessary to require him to bring me back to Edgartown, Kennedy said, slipping easily into euphemism to provide the first obfuscation in his testimony. Drunk, truculent, demanding everyone leave, Crimmins could hardly be said to be enjoying the fellowship. Note: Crimmins testified he didn't know why he hadn't driven the senator to the ferry. The senator had called him out of the cottage to the front yard. "He told me that he was tired and that he wanted to go home and go to sleep. He told me he was going to take Miss Kopechne back, that she wasn't feeling well. She was bothered by the sun on the beach that day." Kennedy asked for the keys to the car. "It was his automobile and I gave them to him. I didn't question him." Crimmins was sure Kennedy left at 11:15 p.m. because I looked at my watch. The district attorney's office had information that Crimmins didn't want to give Kennedy the keys to the car and offered to drive him to the ferry landing, Armand Fernandez revealed after the inquest. But like other investigations we did, it was nothing conclusive.
Although the question wasn't asked, Kennedy denied any personal relationship whatsoever with Mary Jo Kopechne. He had never been out with her when we were not in a general assemblage of friends, associates, or members of our family. He left the party for the ferry landing, traveled down, I believe it is Main Street, and taken a right turn on Dyke Road. Kennedy disposed of Huck Look's anticipated testimony in short order. At no time had he driven into Cemetery Road, backed the car up, or seen anyone between the cottage and Dyke Road, he said. I did not stop the car at any time. I passed no other vehicle. I saw no other person. Kennedy was driving approximately 20 miles an hour, taking no particular notice that Dyke Road was unpaved, or that he was not heading for the ferry landing. He had applied brakes a fraction of a second before I was on the bridge and about to go off, he said. The next thing I recall is the movement of Mary Jo next to me, the struggling, perhaps hitting or kicking me. And I, at this time, opened my eyes and realized I was upside down, that water was crashing in on me, that it was pitch black. And I was able to get a half gulp, I would say, of air, before I became completely immersed in the water. I realized that Mary Jo and I had to get out of the car. Kennedy tried to get the door open by reaching what I thought was down, which was really up, and feeling alongside the door panel to see if the window was open. And I can remember the last sensation of being completely out of air, and inhaling what must have been a half a lung full of water, and assuming that I was going to drown. And the next full realization that no one was going to be looking for us until the next morning, that I wasn't going to get out of that car alive. Then, somehow, coming up to the last energy of just pushing, pressing, and coming up to the surface, he said, I have no idea in the world how I got out of that car. Judge Boyle asked Kennedy to describe what he had seen as he was driving along Dyke Road, from the point when you first saw the bridge. I would estimate that time to be fractions of a second from the time that I first saw the bridge and was on the bridge, Kennedy replied. Your attention was not diverted by anything else, Boyle said. No, it wasn't, Kennedy said. I want to go into the question of alcoholic beverages, Boyle said. Kennedy had two rum and cokes at the party, he said. Boyle wanted to go back before that, he said. I think you said you visited your friends at the Shire Town? Kennedy had a third of a beer at that time, but Boyle hadn't gone back far enough. Kennedy didn't mention the victory party on Ross Richards' boat after the regatta race, at which he drank three rum and cokes. After Boyle was assured that Kennedy had been made aware of his constitutional rights with regard to self-incrimination, he said, "Were you at any time that evening under the influence of alcohol?" Absolutely not, Kennedy said. He had been absolutely sober when he drove over the side of Dyke Bridge, the scene of the accident Denise was anxious to resume his questions about. After Kennedy escaped from the submerged automobile, he was swept away by the tide that was flowing at an extraordinary rate in Poca Pond. Wading up to his waist, he started back to the car, gasping and belching and coughing, to commence diving in an attempt to rescue Mary Jo Kopechne. Prevented from doing so by the fast current, he'd returned again and again to try to gain entrance to the car. Until at the very end, when I couldn't hold my breath any longer. You were fully aware at the time what was transpiring, Denise said, leading up to the question of shock after the accident. Kennedy knew it was coming and tried to slide under the question. Well, I was fully aware that I was doing everything that I possibly could to get the girl out of the car, and that my head was throbbing and my neck was aching, and I was breathless and, at that time, hopelessly exhausted. Kennedy was careful not to say in shock, as Denise was inviting him to. But there was no confusion in your mind about the fact that there was a person in the car, Denise asked, a direct reference to Kennedy's television speech. Kennedy ducked the question again. I was doing the very best I could to get her out, he said. On the last of 7 or 8 attempts to get into the car, he realized, I just couldn't hold my breath any longer. I didn't have the strength to come down even close to the window or the door. I knew that I just could not get underwater anymore. He had lost contact with the car, let himself float to shore. And I sort of crawled and staggered up someplace and was very exhausted and spent on the grass. Kennedy rested on the banking for 15 to 20 minutes. After he regained his breath, I started going down that road, walking, trotting, jogging, stumbling as fast as I possibly could. It was extremely dark, and I could make out no forms or shapes or figures. The only way that I could see the path of the road was looking down the silhouettes of the trees of the two sides. To his knowledge, I never saw a cottage with a light on. He said, artfully, not to say no lights were lit. The walk back to the cottage had taken approximately 15 minutes. A white Valiant was parked 15 to 20 feet outside the front door. As I came up to the back of the vehicle, I saw Ray LaRosa, and I said, Ray, get me Joe. Kennedy climbed into the back seat of the car. Gargan came out, then Paul Markham. Kennedy told them, There's been a terrible accident. Let's go. And returned to Dyke Bridge. I believe that I looked at the Valiant's clock and believe that it was 12:20 a.m., Kennedy said, contriving to establish the time of the accident. When it was discovered by the Boston Globe in 1974 that the Valiant rented for the regatta weekend had no clock, Kennedy admitted, I made a mistake about a clock being in the Valiant that wasn't there. Caught in the lie, he sought to correct his answer retroactively. I am also aware that Paul Markham had a watch on and that he did determine the time. Kennedy had not participated in the rescue efforts undertaken by Gargan and Markham, he said. But I could see exactly what was happening and made some suggestions. You were fully aware of what was transpiring at that time? Denise reiterated, giving Kennedy another chance to lay claim to the shock of his police report and the scrambled thoughts of his television speech. Kennedy wouldn't do it. He was fully aware that Gargan and Markham were trying to get in that car and rescue that girl. But Denise was now leading up to another inevitable subject. Was there any effort made to call for assistance? There was no way around this question. It had to be answered. Kennedy said, No, other than the assistance of Mr. Gargan and Mr. Markham. But they failed in their efforts to recover Miss Kopechne, Denise said. At this critical point in the examination, Judge Boyle interrupted to ask Kennedy to leave the witness stand and the courtroom. Boyle told Denise that, in his view, the purpose of the inquest was to determine whether criminal conduct had contributed to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, and not whether poor judgment or duplicity may have followed. Armand Fernandez recalled, Quite a tussle with Boyle about all questions stopping after the car hit the water and Mary Jo died. He wanted only testimony relating to whether the senator or anyone else had acted criminally in her death, not what anybody did afterward. To Fernandez, a defendant's behavior after a crime was material to any inquiry, especially in view of the omission to act liability under the Walensky decision for manslaughter. Vigorously protesting the limitations Boyle was seeking to place on his examination of witnesses, Denise threatened to walk out of the inquest unless he was allowed more latitude to ask questions. Faced with the disruption of the inquest and the possible collapse of the entire enterprise, Boyle reluctantly acceded. But he would continue to cut Denise off in the middle of questions to admonish him, I want to avoid as much as possible any trial technique. Boyle did not suggest what other method there was to elicit information from a witness. Both were in the dark about inquest procedures. Neither Denise nor Boyle had ever participated in one before. Was there any particular reason why you did not call either the police or the fire department? Denise said when Kennedy resumed the witness stand 20 minutes later. Kennedy tried to duck the question. Well, I intended to call for assistance and report the accident to police within a few short moments after going back into the car. Did something transpire to prevent this? Denise said.
Now, at the most critical point in his testimony, Kennedy's answer on the record would be scrutinized.